Okay, so I was requested not to do any PowerPoint. Okay, so no PowerPoint. And I thought I'd lead with some provocative questions. I think the goal is, overall goal is to see whether from the LIGO data as it is now, or as it will be in 1 year or 2 years or 3 years, whether it's sufficient information for us to decide anything about the origins of these systems and their astrophysical nature, or whether we're completely stuck until BBO gets built and we get arc second positions for every one of these and we know whether they're in spiral arms or in elliptical galaxies or in globular clusters or something, right? Can we figure this out without that? So I guess one thing which has been disturbing me for a while, maybe we can start off, I put up some questions. If we get through these, I'm sure other people can think up some more. I actually have some more too, but I thought these were a good start. So the first one is whether the inferred spins are a problem. So in the absence of any definitive evidence for amplitude modulation from precession, LIGO really constrains the mass-weighted aligned component of the spin from the phasing. And in 1509, the original 30+30 solar mass merger, the constraint, 90% convergence constraint, is that that's less than about 0.15. In the other two, the error ellipses sort of extend up to about 0.4. But it's clearly, both of those are clearly ruling out one, which is the naive expectation if you have two tidally locked synchronized stars which are rotating in the chemically homogeneous model and they collapse. Maybe they actually have A over M larger than one, so you make a disk around them and the disk accretes and some angular momentum gets lost. But I think naively one might have expected that they would both be aligned if they're not kicks, if it's just direct collapse. And they should both be of order one, and that seems to be ruled out. So it was mentioned, well, maybe they're black hole kicks. I remind you, though, that these stars are orbiting, even at their initial stage, at more than 250 kilometers a second, sort of 250 to 500, depending on your models. So if you actually want to misalign these things by 90 degrees to get this down, you're not talking about a 50 kilometer second kick. You're talking about 300 kilometers a second kick, which is comparable to neutron star. And it seems a little surprising maybe if direct collapse of a black hole can produce the same many hundred kilometer a second kicks as the formation of a neutron star. So I wasn't too optimistic about that one. Of course, if you look at Pablo's models, most of the stars which are, well, in fact, all of the stars which are able to merge in less than a Hubble time actually have, at their helium core stage, have more angular momentum than they could directly collapse to a black hole. So you probably would make a collapsar with a disk around it. Naively, I would guess that angular momentum goes in with the disk rather than out, but anyway. So that's my introduction to the problem.
We're quite simplistic in our models of assuming, okay, you form this helium star, and in the end, you just bring all the angular momentum in. But even so, the strength of winds during the Wolf-Rayet phase is very important. And what we get is, well, we cannot go as down as 0.15, of course. But we have black holes at around 0.5. So, well, it's still quite a lot. You still would need pretty hefty kicks if you want to get it to that level. But, well, jumping from 1 to 0.5, it goes
a start,
in that direction.
But it's good. Yeah, I mean, I guess, I don't know, is Juna here? Yeah, there was this nice paper by Doran Kushnir and Juna and so on where they looked exactly at these Wolf-Rayet winds. And, their point was even not in the chemically homogeneous model, but in the model where you just do some conventional evolution where you have a black hole and a Wolf-Rayet star in a close binary, that generically, if you tidally synchronize, you end up with the Wolf-Rayet star. If it's going to be able to merge in a Hubble time, it ends up being essentially a greater than about point, certainly greater than 0.5 or so. And for the 30 solar mass star, I think they could get down to maybe 0.2. But again, it depends on the wind. If you put in an extremely strong wind with a catastrophic late mass loss, then you can push it down a little bit. Of course, you may also reduce the black hole's mass substantially. So it's not clear whether if one wants to make 30, if you want huge winds and late time mass loss from iron bumps or something, whether you can still end up with 30. But, you're in gravity.
So in general, I mean, the best the knowledge about what Ray stars is about galactic stars. Now you were talking about low metallicity. In such cases, so usually we find relatively small rotation. But it is difficult to measure the rotation because the lines are broken by the wind effect. And there are a few stars, a minority, where we have the impression that the wind co-rotates up to a couple of stellar radii. And this can only be explained if there is a magnetic field. And then the angular momentum loss, of course, is much more than you would expect without co-rotation.
On the other hand, I guess one of the points that the Kushner's paper was making is that these are in very close binaries, and so even if you have a wind, you're continuously tidally spinning it back up again. And so the constraint is not just how much angular momentum is lost, but whether it actually beats the tidal coupling. And they basically argue that unless you had a very strong wind, you couldn't do that.
I'd be surprised if the tidal coupling is strong because, I mean, you have a star that, well, it had to be essentially a main sequence star at the beginning and then it contracted.
No, but they're just looking at the Wolf-Rayet phase on. They ignore the early part. So their point is that the Wolf-Rayet star, even when it's one solar radius, already gets tidally locked. I mean, they start long after in the main sequence phase.
That's a result that surprises me.
Well, it's not so. I mean, it's a few tenths, I think, but yeah. There's a radius to the ninth in there or something, which comes in. So yeah, but. Well, but 100 kilometers a second is already too much to produce A over M of 1, right? I mean, so if the upper limit is just 100 kilometers a second and then it's at a 10-day orbit, I'm not sure that constrains this at all. Yeah. Sorry, I missed the logic there, sorry. I missed your logic. You're talking about binary stars and open star clusters?
Binary star clusters, it's easier to get them spin after the merger because they have an initially higher intrinsic value.
Yeah, Luis?
So this is a kind of really sad comment, but just to represent people that might not be in the audience. So if astrophysically one ends up coming from trying to explain these low spins, they are interacting with other fields that can easily bring down the spin, where we believe that models or not. I mean, it would be interesting to know how people think about what it does.
You mean extensions to relativity? You mean
no. Imagine there are scalar fields, for example,
right.
That are explaining dark matter or whatever, so they can just, through supervision, they can drain the speed.
Right, so once the black hole is formed, basically, it's a non-mechanism.
I was wondering, do the speed measurements from X-ray binaries, are they of any help here? I know they're tricky.
I would say, I think the majority of them basically are claiming they're 0.99. And that rather remarkably includes the ones where it's a 10 solar mass black hole and a 0.3 solar mass companion, right? It's not just the Cygnus X1s of the world where you might have expected to accrete a significant amount. So I think it's right that that depends on one's belief in the models of the ISCO radius and the disks and so on, but they are, I think, on average claiming that even black holes which have not accreted very much material are highly spinning in the galactic disk. Yep.
So I think we talked a little bit about this. If you're embedding the binary in gas, in an AGN disk model, if they both have mini disks around them, right, you should expect them both to have high spins. So we should count that as a mark, essentially, against an AGN model, unless there's...
Again, if they've grown significantly by accretion,
right,
transformation.
Right, if that's the case, yeah. Mm.
So any other...
yes,
I think that's a short answer.
Maybe I can do some last quick comment regarding the tidal part when you have the Wolf-Rayet star. I think that actually works the other way around. If you have tidal synchronization there, it will actually slow down your star because you would expect plenty of spin-up once you contract to go into a Wolf-Rayet star. So you would be over-synchronous.
No, but they're starting with the Wolf-Rayet. I mean, forgetting. I think they've already started at the Wolf-Rayet phase in this paper. So they're just assuming that it's synchronously spun down or spun up. It doesn't matter, but they're just starting it with synchronization and then following the evolution.
Okay, so maybe I need to check that.
Yeah.
It would be interesting to better model the tides in such systems because we're all, I don't know exactly what they did, but I'm sure they
copied John's formula, which was John's 1970 paper, I guess. Elliot, do you want to? I mean, I know there have been many improvements. I don't know why they chose that. Yeah. I mean, I think the Jean, it was just the convective core and completely ignoring any G modes in the outer part and stuff. Oh, this was a dynamical one. Yeah.
So I think this is, we don't understand how it's very well, but all of the theoretical conditions tend to not be efficient enough. So I would say this is, if anything, an underestimate, meaning you might expect even more annual
momentum
or more efficient spin-up.
So I guess, do you have any comments on the possibility of late catastrophic mass loss and whether one could remove enough angular momentum without reducing the black hole mass too much?
Yeah, that seems I think the future paper, the argument that they settled on was that if you have, let's see if I remember this correctly, systems that have long merger time.
Yeah, basically, you have to start, if the merger time is of order 10 to the 10 years, then it's wide enough that you start a bit slow, and if you have a win, then you can avoid a problem, basically.
Yeah, so what you want is the kind of a self-consistent story. The systems that take a long time to merge were systems that were kind of in the tidal spin-up phase relatively wide, and so you don't actually have all that much energy. So that's their best case scenario for getting the worst spin.
And it kind of barely makes it.
But anyhow, this is something that should affect as well the common envelope evolution channel.
Yeah, well, I mean, they're so considering the common envelope evolution channel. Yeah. That's the one they're considering even. I think it's only, but and that's just, you know, that in that case, in the common envelope, you can start with one black hole of spin zero, maybe. And then the problem is just the other one. In the chemically homogeneous, I think you have a problem because you have two of them, so you got to work this for both of them, not just one of them. So.
Once again, I think if they come from star cluster, it's less of a problem. You can't end up back to this discussion next
So to come back to the X-ray binary, so maybe the people who do binary evolution and comment, the same models that say predict spins of one in chemically homogeneous evolution case, if you do binary evolution,
I think the chemically homogeneous evolution, you don't want to don't produce any of the X-ray binaries, I think, or hardly any of them. Not in the standard channel.
If you have this, there will be things that just fail that will make
Yeah, that's right. So right. Those, is there any comment on what spins those might be expected to have?
So you're thinking high mass X-ray binaries as opposed to the AO620s, which I think really
that's
are...
That's a question for the normal channel as well, right?
Yes.
Yeah. I mean, because I think AO620 is pretty hard to make other than by a common envelope, right? It's 0.3 solar mass companion with a 10 solar mass black hole.
It might be interesting to hear the
Yeah, well, I think in the standard model, for, at least for the you know the X-ray transients, where it's you know a very extreme mass ratio, I think you're kind of stuck with the spiral in, and then the question is really what is the angular momentum in the core of a extreme red giant, where you've spiraled in the companion from, you know, 1,000 solar radii to 1 solar radius or something, and like that probably depends on differential rotation in red giants or something. So maybe it's harder to be predictive, even harder to be predictive. But it certainly is a constraint because they do have a lot of angular momentum. So if you had a rigidly rotating giant, it probably doesn't work. Yeah. Right, but those have almost all been spun down by the accretion torques, right? I mean, the standard story is that they're its propellers.
Because those which I'm talking about, they're embedded in the means of supergens. They do not accrete a disk, they accrete this our spherical.
Right, but they still have propeller to spin them down, probably. So, I mean, yeah, this crab maybe is useful. I'm not so sure the X-ray binaries are useful as a model of the initial spin.
Here,
let me start one on this side.
So all the discussions I have with stellar physicists is on the worrying side. Maybe we're having some hope for this channel for personal bias, but that's a different story. Mm-hmm. But all the supernova theorists I talk to, Philip, I don't know if I have many people here, but they seem to be extremely careful in making any statement how the spin of the final product relates to the final compact object. I share your view for the fallback, but it's my simple high school mechanics that is playing a role.
Right, but I think the supernova is quite different though. But the supernova is very different because here I think you're wanting the whole star to go in, right, as opposed to just 10% of the star, right? So I think it's easier to predict the angular momentum of the whole star than 10% of the star.
Right, I guess that would be even more complicated than you know, how does that evolve? Like, what does your central object, which is the remainder of that supernova, actually end up with in terms of angular momentum?
So I guess, does anybody want to comment on the collapsar? I mean, I think, you know, in this picture, the simple conclusion is that the helium stars have too much angular momentum, and therefore they will make a collapsar. The black hole will bounce. Some of it will make a black hole. The rest will make a disk. And then, you know, the question of what the subsequent evolution is then what determines the angular momentum.
Not necessarily, because the canonical
No, but I'm just saying that in these models, all the systems that were able to merge in a Hubble time did have too much angular momentum to directly make a black hole at in the stellar phase, right?
I also have these models that are able to merge in a Hubble time, but are still at A equal 0.5. So you need to push down to lower metallicities precisely because you don't want too much spin down during the Wolf-Rayet phase. But this goes all together coupled with our uncertainties on how winds operate
right.
in a Wolf-Rayet star.
Right, but like, the crucial point is it's going to depend on enhanced winds, right? I mean, without the winds, there's a problem without appealing to jacking up some Wolf-Rayet winds.
Well, is it really a problem? I guess it would be a problem if you start overproducing this. This kind of thing. So if you would be producing too many collapsars, and if you believe they result in long gamma ray bursts, but, well, I guess so long as the numbers are not chewed up and you get something in terms of a rate of possible gamma ray bursts, then it's not necessarily a problem.
It's the spin is a problem, right?
Only three objects.
Yeah.
I guess I would make two comments about the collapsar. Andrew could probably chime in, other people here. But I guess I would naively think that, you know, you have so much angular momentum, you're forming a fairly large accretion disk during the collapse. Naively, you'd think that maybe that efficiency by which the matter actually makes it into the black hole might not be very high. Right, they say, okay, forming a thick disk, it probably wins, you know. We have to actually start off with even more massive star to end up with a 30 solar mass rapidly spinning black hole. So I guess that's one, you know, that would be one comment. But I think it would be hard to not have a near maximally spinning black hole if you're creating the situation. I guess the other one I would say is that we may expect very different black hole kicks if we go through a collapse, potentially, if we go through a collapse star phase. I don't know if this has been looked at, but I mean, you're shooting out fairly powerful jets. It's maybe, they're not entirely symmetric. I mean, I don't know if people have thought as much about what types of kicks those might impart to the black hole. I don't know if that's relevant or not, but maybe you may get very different black hole kicks in a case where you have such a large angular momentum. So I don't know if it's going to be high enough, several hundred, to missile and spin. Has anyone else thought about that or opinions on that? Just, I don't know, the jet's 20% more powerful in one
direction. I think a comment about the spin is that even if I assume the black hole was non-spinning when it first started accreting, it grew to around 0.7 very quickly. Mm-hmm. So, yeah. And I assume that was initially sitting at 0.5, that was up to 0.95 very quickly as well.
So, Elliot, did you have a...
did the one calculation. It's easy to do. The question of does neutrino mass loss eject any interesting amount of matter in these more lower metallicity high mass stars? So this is the story that even if you have a quote direct collapse, you still radiate a fair amount of neutrino binding energy away, which in principle can unbind some of the star. For red supergiants, it actually unbinds an interesting amount of mass. But for low metallicity progenitors, like we think are maybe we'll skip a little bit, maybe are more relevant here, you have more compact stars at core collapse, and you lose a quite small amount of mass. So I don't think that's a way to shed either an interesting amount of mass, which is relevant. Or an interesting matter. So has anybody actually done a 30 solar mass helium, full helium core, 30 solar mass iron core collapse?
Not with like all the ingredients we need to kind of answer these questions.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, there certainly are two sort of low-mass black hole transients where the proper motions are like 200 kilometers a second. But in both of those cases, there's evidence that the companion star has supernova R-process elements in the photosphere that suggests that it was, you know, one of these things that was caused by fallback, but it actually was a supernova, which is maybe a little different than what we want in these. Okay, so maybe we'll turn to the next one. So, you know, this seems like a very nice story for making 30 plus 30 solar mass black holes, but as I understand at least the simple versions, it does not make 7 plus 16 or 13 plus 20, the other two, so it works for 1 out of 3. And it also, I guess, one only seems to get radius shrinkage if the metallicity is less than about the tenth of solar, so the naive simple versions require that it's not happening in the local universe except in a few little dwarf galaxies or something. And one consequence of that, it seems to me, is if you look at the integrated star formation history of the universe and ask when most of the stars of this metallicity were formed, it's redshifts higher than 1. So that means that you have that the systems that produce work this way all have to have delay, are the ones with delay times between 8 and 12 gigayears. Everything that had a delay time less than 8 gigayear already merged and is no longer in the LIGO horizon. And so it's a pretty narrow range that corresponds to about a 4% width in the semi-major axis in that range of in spiral times. So
the reason it needs to go like this thing is different for single stars, it's also the trend, but there it has to do with spin down. For the binaries, they do homogeneous evolution at higher metallicity, no problem. The reason that they don't make black holes is because in the current assumptions that we have, it is the mass loss from these Wolf Rayet stars that widens the system.
That's right.
And that makes the gravitational wave shrinking time too long. Mm-hmm. And so the simple assumption here we've both been taking is the assumption of spherical winds that leave the system rapidly, and that will always give widening of the system. Now, the orbital velocity of these stars is in the order of 600 kilometers a second, that is similar order as the wind speed. So this is a very simple assumption that should be explored there that might actually save the metallicity threshold, if you wanted to save it. But the
stellar radius, I thought there was also a constraint about the stellar radius expanding and producing overflow, right?
So the staying compact, for that you need to mix.
Mm-hmm.
And that you can go up to higher metallicities. Maybe if you go too high, maybe the iron subsurface convection thing will be like, maybe you can come
Well, I haven't gone so high, but I guess there must be a limit where, well, we run into other issues we have in understanding very massive stars, which is whether or not you get envelope inflation, for instance.
Right, yeah.
So that would essentially produce the stars to go into very deep contact, probably, and it wouldn't work. But I think there are issues like what Selma was talking about that could push this threshold higher up. But
I think, I mean, do you think it will work with solar metallicity? I thought the issue was basically the winds, the expansion of the star and everything basically kind of.
Well, I think pushing it all the way to solar is way too much. Right. Maybe quarter solar, right. I would say.
SMC, right. I think it's much harder to push the mass down than to push the metallicity threshold.
Well, but we also have an SMC counterpart that seems to have gone through chemically homogeneous evolution, so it's 260 solar mass helium stars, but they're at a 20-day orbit. So these two seem to be right in the sense of they might form black holes in the end, but they're already too wide to form emerging black holes.
Mm-hmm. But trying to push it down to being an explanation for the 15 plus 7 or something also seems very difficult, is that?
Yes, so this is, I mean, there is this level of uncertainty on these calibrations for mixing, but we cannot push it too far because, as Selma said, then we screw up normal stars.
Mm-hmm.
We would expect loads of helium enrichment in relatively slowly rotating LOMA intermediate mass star.
We should do the experiment.
Because I guess the two things. One is whether whether you screw anything up in the abundances. The other is whether you overproduce X-ray binaries or something compared to the traditional common envelope channel, right? That you don't want to, you know, there's stories that have been developed and rates that have been done. One doesn't want to.
Yeah, so that's, well, I will briefly mention it on Thursday, but there's also a possibility of forming ultra-luminous X-ray sources. I mean, if you're forming these very massive black holes,
right.
If for some reason you end up accreting to them, you form an ultra-luminous source. Mm-hmm. And the thing is that you do not want to overproduce this as well.
Right.
So there are constraints coming on several sides.
Mm-hmm. So any more comments on this? So I guess there's then the potentially...
I can just comment that, as we discussed with you yesterday, so that there are really high uncertainties on mass loss rates at low metallicities, and that's... Some controversy raging in our field when people are saying that these traditional recipes do not work, and other people say that they work. And for really low metallicity stars, even for SMC type metallicities, we perhaps confident maybe an order of magnitude, but maybe not better than that. And that's already going to another experiment to make, how it is going to affect the evolutionary models.
Yeah, I mean, one could do that experiment of trying to do sort of this population synthesis game of modifying the input a bit and see what comes out. But I guess since it's a bit expensive to run these detailed models with all that, you need to think very well what experiment you want to run in the beginning.
So in terms of galaxy evolution, you can actually form a significant amount of low metallicity stars even in the local-ish universe, like less than 2 or 4 giga years. If you have...
Well, I guess I was just, maybe, I don't know if you have, in your paper you showed breakdown by the galaxy mass, which isn't the useful thing because you want to integrate over all galaxies, but it looks like all of them were basically peak at a hundredth of a solar metallicity. They were essentially all peaking at redshift 1 or 2, right?
Yeah, 100 solar, yes, but if you...
At a tenth of solar, you can sort of push it down a degree to lower,
So there's actually an updated plot of this. And so the distribution is bimodal. You have the slightly higher metallicity that it stars that form at higher redshift in more massive galaxies, and then there's the low metallicity group at lower redshift in smaller galaxies. And so if you integrate everything, it's flattish in terms of formation time from... 2 giga years all the way down to 8 giga years, but you have two different blobs, but the way they add up make it more flat.
Yeah, but I think in the context of these chemically homogeneous models, I think it's really more, you know, a tenth of solar metallicity doesn't work, and so it actually is the lower ones which are kind of peaked. I think for the BSE kind of models like you were investigating, then it's just the winds, and so a tenth of the solar metallicity was okay, modulo changes in winds and stuff. Okay, let's see. So I guess let's come to the birth rates now. So the LIGO sort of integrating all three sources has a birth rate of 9 to 240 for cubic gigaparsecs, of which I think, you know, a order, a third or something was from each of the sources, crudely. and I guess the first question is, does that rule out the dynamical models that we heard this morning, at least as a dominant contributor to, I don't know if Duncan wants to, or anybody else in the LSC wants to place bets on where in this range is the preferred, from your emotional... Well, I think the models we saw were sort of producing 1, 3, and 5, which is...
Yeah, so the rates we derived with the more recent updates, I mean, vary from about 2 to 20 is the range on that. And that's just for clusters. There's obviously galactic nuclei, which are a lot more uncertain. AGN, which I was corrected, actually the rates there are about 3 per gigaparsec cubed per year. I would point out, just in our own defense, obviously, because I'm a little biased, I mean, the median for a lot of these rate distributions, at least for the flat one and the event-based ones, are about, around, 40 per gigaparsec cubed per, reading these off in a, obviously, very ham-fisted fashion. But there's also the other question that, because you're looking at low metallicity exclusively for globular clusters, in particular, you're obviously going to have a larger detection range for that. So even though, say, globules are maybe only producing 5 gigaparsec cubed per year, those are going to be observable at much farther horizon distance, just because they're typically more massive. We don't really produce 10 plus 10, or barely even 20 plus 20 solar masses.
That should be included in
the rate. I mean, that should be in the, already in the rate, right? I mean, if you've done it correctly.
The rate is bracketed by, so there's three ways we did the rate, right? There's the uniform and log component mass, so you see the So just the people who don't have a paper in front of them, so the lower end comes from the uniform and log component masses, which probably overestimates the high mass black holes and so underestimates the rate. And then the 240 is from assuming a power law to the minus 2.4-ish on one component mass, and then uniform in the other component mass, which probably underestimates the log mass, and so you don't get as big a VT, and so
So if you just do a sort of crude V over V max on the three sources and don't, put in modest Poisson statistics, what is the, I thought the answer for that is sort of in the middle of, yeah, I thought that was like 70 or something like that.
Just the event-based ones, 60.
I think that has a long way to go, yes. I guess. I think 10 to the 5 or something. Yeah, but just to make it cleaner, we specifically threw out the clusters that disrupted before 12 figures. Because when we were looking.
How much time is your binary check?
Usually, especially the massive one, we reject it in the first figure.
So you only need your clusters to survive for a figure.
Yeah, which we totally neglected just because we didn't want to try and fold in a star formation history or any of that stuff.
1 gigaear, 10 gigaear, 5 to 10.
Yeah, I was just doing it. I mean, I think you do have to struggle if you really want to get up towards the high end. I think it's a bit of a struggle, right? That the Milky Way has of order 100 globular clusters, maybe less if you count the ones that are dense enough to be doing interesting stuff. You know, if each amount of them manages to have 100 heavy black holes to kick out and 100 binaries to kick out in 10 to the 10 years, I think that's kind of straining the limits from the pulsar data. Then, and even if you do that uniformly over time rather than push towards high redshift, then that's 10 per cubic gigaparsec per year, yeah, kicking out every single one of them. Right?
Yeah,
so, right, but the problem is that doesn't help the LIGO problem, because the LIGO is only seeing them within a gigaparsec. If you had produced short-lived clusters that dissolved long ago, they're not contributing to the local rate.
I mean, so the things that disrupt before 12 leap years, the thing is those are preferentially going to be the smaller globular clusters anyway, the ones that can be, you know, eventually shredded by the galaxy.
Well, or just the ones in the inner galaxy. Yeah. It's typically more strongly dependent on radius. Yeah.
But those are going to be the ones that, I mean, because they have such a small tidal boundary and because they're preferentially lower mass, those are going to be the ones that eject binaries with very wide separations anyway, which at least are going to have a, you know, a much smaller fraction of those. Mm-hmm. Are
what's the mass function? Is that many of these low mass ones?
I mean, if you believe the star formation, I mean the cluster formation theory, then it's 1/n². So there should be huge populations going down to almost just 100 M.
I mean, the other story is that the whole galactic halo is, stellar halo is made out of them, so then you do need several times more. But I think, as you say, the problem is if those are the halo is made out of fluffy ones, they don't actually contribute to the rate much.
This gets us back into that scary problem that I put at the end of the talk, where what exactly is the field? It's all just disrupted clusters anyway, and how much of a role has dynamics played? Has it thrashed the field population? Has it completely left it alone?
So suppose that the answer to your second question there is yes, right? It does. We have rules now. Done.
Right.
I mean, if there are multiple channels of work, mm-hmm, beyond eccentricity, which is the obvious thing for dynamical capture, what are possible signatures that could say that, you know, dynamical plays a significant role versus field binary?
I mean, spin precession. You have spins, and they kind of mean, you know, you have completely isotropic distribution clusters. What the hell else is it going to be? Especially for massive things, if you assume that the tilt alignment on the orbit is the only thing that can dislodge, you have a supernova kick. Then, like for GW 15914, we could have actually observed multiple precession cycles and actually seen the thing precess. I mean, unless you assume that 30 solid-mass black holes can get significant negative kicks, or that they were born, as Richard pointed out, or if they were born completely misaligned to begin with.
Right.
I personally don't know enough about the initial spin orientation of field binaries.
But I think the enlarge is probably giving you direct fallback, so you're not going to get big kicks. So
yeah.
You're going to get big misalignments.
That's the simple picture I've always told myself, but I'm not sure how.
So I think the clear statement is if they're aligned.
Then I think it's bad for this.
Yeah, but in all the other cases, even then, there are stories that can be.
Yeah. What I always imagine is, like, as you dial up the mass, you know, you're increasing the fallback fraction, you're getting closer to zero negative. And so for the field, anyway, the spin tilt misalignment will get smaller and smaller for the field, whereas for clusters, it should just be, you know, isotropic all the way through. So it'd be really nice if you get, like, 100 signals, you see two of them are processing to do the model selection and figure out, you know, for these masses, you might be able to start constraining naval kicks, you might be able to start constraining different populations.
I guess the bad news would be if all the spins end up being low because there's spectacular mass loss late in the evolution.
Short delay patches are things we could eventually see as a stochastic background, right? If they're not there, there's no background either.
Yeah. You You can produce. I mean, it's entirely a function of the cluster potential. So if you have, like, if you very early on have a very dense, very massive cluster, then that's going to be, you know, ejecting binaries with electrons of maybe tens of megameters. But as they puff up and they get closer to the present day, then they're just going to, then you get years again.
So for the isolated channel, parallel is slightly different results, but the common envelope can get much closer. You can get the
right, you can have shorter delay
times. Has much shorter delay times than my version of the chemical evolution, but parallel is slightly different.
You can go quite low. I mean, it's almost arbitrary with respect to the metallicity you have. If you push the metallicity very, very, very low, then you can get 0.5.
So
yeah. So.
So I think in your paper, Astrid, right, the peak was from around in the standard model, the peak was around 0.1 solar metallicity, in the sense that at the lower ones, the delay times were all very long, and in the higher ones, it was harder to make the systems, right? So the peak ended up being sort of a tenth of the solar metallicity.
Yeah, it's a combination of the two peaks.
Yeah. Right. So the last thing I had here, which I guess we started a little bit, is, you know, we have all these stories. As usual, the theorists have wiggle rooms for. So the question is, you know, tests. Okay, so we got one. If all spins are large and aligned, that's probably bad for dynamics and maybe good for this one. On the other hand, the first three weren't large, so that's already a little bit of a little bit of a worry. Is there anything about the rate sort of between 0 and 1 gigaparsecs that we can begin to say something about metallicities again without positions? Or any other ideas people want to bring up? Yeah? Yeah, I mean, I looked at the sort of high mass X-ray binary birth rate, where they're both large, I sort of estimated before. I couldn't find a good, really good paper on it. It's about 50 or something, I think. So this is sort of making essentially all of those into binary black holes. So 240 is a problem. I think 50 or 70 is probably bearable. But if it stays at 240.
Well, so talking about test, I think other than bringing ELISA up, which would be extremely useful, I guess with more detections we can start talking about mass distributions. So I think there, since for instance this the chemically homogeneous evolution predicts more massive black holes, and all the other ones go to way lower masses, then I think that would be pretty indicative of what's going on.
But do you think it's already indicative?
I mean, huh?
Do you think it's already indicative if we believe all three of these? Is that already evidence that one for chemical evolution, chemically homogeneous evolution, and two for standard evolution?
Well, we've got one for each. that's also a thing. For the chemically homogeneous evolution, you have that it's sort of the most efficient way to turn a star into a black hole in the end, because you're turning the full star into a core. So you have these things that, given massive enough binaries, you would expect to see over 100 solar mass black holes. So that's an option, I think, that could allow us to discern between things. If we see some of these very massive mergers, those are quite hard to make in the standard channels.
So Duncan, do you have an impression of when will I, is 100 solar mass accessible given the current sort of low frequency sensitivity, or would that have to wait for improvements in low frequency to get a reasonable rate at 100 solar mass black holes? No, 100 plus 100, I think. It's 200.
There's an IMPH search going on that's pushing that, but
Right. Mm-hmm. So you detect them, but maybe you don't know what the masses are, I guess.
You detect
the
notable high mass.
Right.
You don't get like
all of
that.
Mm. Yeah,
right. At 100, even with the current sort of mass of the descent.
Or you may think that you're equal lower mass, but extremely high speed. Back in 1 day.
Well, actually, some of the more massive ones, you would expect them to have spins close to zero, because they would have extremely strong winds when they're Wolf Rayet stars.
Yeah.
I think a couple of extra science runs would be very useful.
So just to push this question, so is the signal, if you just see the bursty part, can you separate mass and spin very well? So misaligned, anti-aligned spins or something could screw everything.
But it starts to look very like a sine Gaussian, right?
Yeah. So I mean, in terms of the parameter estimation, I guess the question is whether one can actually distinguish. I mean, 30 plus 30, I think, there, you know, is shown, but 100 plus 100 or something.
It's not possible. If you make such massive black holes in clusters, you should also find out each other one someday.
Yeah.
So the argument in favor that Paolo just made in favor of homogeneous evolution is it's very efficient in getting to this high mass because the whole star would fall back in. If it's normal evolution, only the core of it.
Yeah, so It's the IMF that would favor it in the end. I mean, you would need extremely massive stars in single star evolution to get to that point.
No, I think that does depend on the winds at low metallicity to some extent, right?
The argument
made
in the clusters is that if density is high enough, you could smash multiple stars into each other, and this is how single point is smart one and make even minimal black holes.
Yeah. So, well, I think perhaps in this multiple merger scenario that you have, I mean, because this could produce very massive black holes with very high spins as well, which...
Well, I think you were talking about stellar mergers, right?
Stellar mergers.
Right, the Colgate 1970 or something.
Yeah, that's... Yes, so...
You mean sort of 10, 6 plus 60 or something like that? Is that 10, right. So I guess that's a good point. So for both the sort of standard scenarios and for chemically homogeneous, is 6 plus 60 seems quite hard to mate.
I don't think we have fully explored half homogeneous channel. I mean, we're just starting to explore what all the side products are, right? Mm-hmm. So if the first star would go homogeneous, and the other star would be much lower mass, it doesn't do much for a long time.
Right.
And then we have a very massive one, and the second one is low mass, filling its rush up, it would be stable, so it would be a high mass ultra-luminous X-ray source potentially for a while.
Mm-hmm.
But if then that lower mass companion would eventually form a 6 solar mass black hole, I don't know what the rates for this are.
Yeah, so I think the main issue about that is you will have a binary that undergoes Roche-Love overflow, so you will end up with a bit of a wide system. So this works in terms of forming, for instance, neutron star black hole mergers in a small rate. I still need to actually get the rate for that. But you need the kick, favorable kicks to put it into a,
right,
to bring
wide,
it back to a,
push it into an eccentric orbit.
Yeah. So, well, if you want to put, make merging black, double black holes, then you go to the question again, how strong can black hole kicks be? But well, at least for neutron stars, we know they have kicks. So the possibility is there. Maybe it's just borderline possible, but. Yeah, I think some of those get to the to that mass ratio. I think I will try to produce some actual numbers through the week on that. But yeah.
Well, no, 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 because, well, let me say that the standard channel has such great flexibility. I think. It's been studied for a long time and every knob is known.
Yeah, I guess
I'm just wondering how high mass, you know, LIGO need to go to make a detector, no? Of course, make sure we'll determine that.
Yeah.
In order to put in a couple of samples.
So it's about 90 or 100 for the classical channel. Total mass beyond that gets hard. So if you start seeing 100.
But it gets hard because nobody has ever done, you know, really, you know, any evolutions where you put it or not. No.
The microphone is mainly for recording rather than
I think Stan's going to talk about this later, but there's parent stability problems, and you've included this in your models, right? So you can also talk about this. There's parent stability problems when you go to really high mass. Now, if you have a procedure that will naturally let you go to really high mass, then that's a different story. But
yeah, so
in our channels, there's usually a gap at around.
Yeah, so the procedure is to have a core that's massive enough such that this parent stability problem stops being a problem. The models predict you get collapse if you get helium cores above 130 solar masses. So in principle, that would be the lowest very massive black hole that you could produce from stellar sources, you could say.
So talking about besides the parent stability, we have the pulsational parent stability, which would still leave a black hole, right? So I'm wondering if the 30 plus 30, the first event, if that would be a pulsational parent stability, that would be a nice mechanism to lose mass in late stages and spin them down. I'm not trying to save coming here with this solution for it.
Yeah, by the way, I don't know what she was. I tried to lead in. I hope she wants to come up and show something. Maybe we can have the shoes. Yeah.
Oh, yeah, don't worry about that. Oh, there's plenty of evidence right
here. If you see it back, it happened in Asia.
I was just wondering, since someone has talked about it, I'm not advocating it in any ways, but nobody has said much about population 3 models. There was sort of someone shrugged it off, like, okay, there are not many stars formed in population 3. So does anyone want to say anything about that and why you've just sort of implicitly dismissed it?
I did this over lunch as well, but so, well, if anyone wants to speak up and go against that, I would love to hear, but so,
the rates go with how much mass is formed in stars at a metallicity of zero. So this, if you want population three stars to be of importance, you need two things to be fine-tuned. One of them is you need delay times for almost exactly a Hubble time, because the peak of the population three stars was a while ago. And the second is you need an extremely efficient mechanism to turn all the population three gas, basically, into these kind of events to be of any importance for the rates. So they might, it might well be one of the channels, but I don't see any simple reason for it to be of any significance. That would be my provocative statement. But unless we have no idea of a mechanism that boosts it as much as we think the masses involved in those stars are in the wrong direction.
Yeah, if I can make this work. So this is a work that I've done with some other people at Caltech, but it's now accepted, so you can find it on the archive, and it will be published soon. So the idea was to really look at the detection of these black holes from a different perspective, from the galaxy evolution perspective. And the reason why... Why we started thinking about this was, okay, what we know from having 230 solar mass black holes is it has to have some low metallicity. That's the basic stellar evolution model. And the question is, okay, where do we actually find these? Naively, we know that high redshift means lower metallicity. We also think about dwarfs, but then dwarfs have limited star formation, but there's many of them. So if you take all this into account, what's actually the region where, which one wins? So I went to my boss, Phil Hopkins, and I was like, which one actually wins? He said, actually, I don't know. And when he told me that, I figured, okay, I should keep digging. So the idea was to combine a binary population synthesis model with a more refined model for galaxy evolution and to see how we can predict where and when this, these binaries form. So where I mean in what type of galaxy, which mass, and when I mean a redshift of formation. So the idea really was to look at the galaxy part of things and not so much on the binary population synthesis. So we took the more the classic binary population synthesis model. If you want me to, if we would want to do the same thing for the other channels, I just need a delay time distribution and plug it in. So I won't go into the details of the binary evolution model because it's not the point of the paper. We wanted to have basically differential rates as a function of formation time and formation galaxy rather than having the total rate and reproducing the LIGO rate. That was not exactly what we were going for. So our binary population synthesis model is based on the BSC code. And so what we actually use as input for the paper is the delay time distribution. So here I have three models. So this would be 100 solar, which produces most of the mergers. There is a 10 solar in black, which is the more favored case. And this would be an extreme case of a third solar, which is actually a bit too high to produce many mergers. And you see that most of the mergers are actually produced many giga years after the formation of the initial stars. Only in the low metallicity, very low metallicity case, you can have fast mergers, and you can't have them at higher metallicity just because the stars would typically merge as stars and not as black holes. So this is the input for our galaxy evolution model. It's just this delay time distribution. So the idea is really was really for us, for each galaxy mass we considered and each metallicity bin we looked at, was to trace all the star formation all the way from redshift 8 to until redshift 0.1, which is where the black holes merged, and to see, okay, how many stars form at each time step, what is my metallicity, and how many of these low metallicity stars will actually merge at redshift 0.1, given that I have my delay time distribution. So we have time steps of 10 million years, which is small enough to capture all the interesting evolution of star formation. We have a full mass metallicity relation, which means that we compute the mean metallicity of each galaxy dependent on redshift and on mass, and most of the work that has been done is typically ignoring the mass dependence of the metallicity, so it's just considering a global metallicity evolution in the universe. And this takes into account the fact that dwarfs have, on average, a much lower metallicity than more massive galaxies. We also include some scatter in that relation, and we include scatter within a given galaxy, because the further you go out, the lower your metallicity, and then you can also have scatter at a given galactocentric radius. So that is one key aspect that makes it different from the things that you usually find in the literature. The other aspect is galaxy mergers. The idea is that if you take a Milky Way type galaxy and you look at it now, about 30% of the stars that are in there were formed somewhere else. And so if we think about low metallicity stars, the ones we're looking at, there's actually more of them that were formed in dwarfs and then ended up in our galaxy. So if we were to find where those binaries are now, we have to include everything that formed here and then ends up in my more massive galaxy. And so including these mergers actually changed our rate by a factor of 5 for certain masses. So this is something you should not be ignoring. So what we did is basically for each mass and each redshift, we have the distribution of basically galaxies that will merge within that galaxy by redshift 1. So this is basically a dark matter halo model that gives you a distribution of masses that will merge within the main halo by redshift 1. This is a semi-analytic dark matter halo model. And we have 11 redshift bins that, metallicity bins that cover between 100 and solar metallicity. And so if we look at, this is an awful plot, I'm really sorry. This is the amount of low metallicity gas that is formed at different times. So this is time, so this is high redshift, low redshift. Don't look at the actual numbers, doesn't really matter. So the dotted lines are the 100 solar metallicity, and you see that everything is formed here in low metallicity high redshift systems.
You have a similar plot where the thing is sort of confusing about this is LIGO doesn't know anything about galaxy masses, they just care about the integral. You have an integrated plot.
Yes.
Integrated over all the galaxies.
It's the one right after. So this is just low metallicity gas. There are no black holes in here. This is just telling you that the universe forms low metallicity stuff basically all the way from 10 gigayears ago to now. That's basically what you want to take away, is where is low metallicity star-forming gas? Now, if you look at, this is to remind you that mergers, galaxy mergers, are important, and you should not ignore them if you want to do estimates of rates, because they do matter. And so, Sterl, I guess this is what you were looking for. So this is... So I'm looking at three things, metallicity, galaxy mass, and formation time. So these are 2D representations of these 3D, of this 3D distribution. So one of them has galaxy mass and formation time. And so this is what I was saying. You have one part of the distribution that is formed at high redshift in typically massive galaxies, so this is like our Milky Way. And this is another part of the distribution which is formed much more recently, between 2 and 6 gigayears typically, in dwarf galaxies. Now if you look at the total distribution, so the two side plots would be integrals over the other axis, you see that formation time is typically flat all the way from now until about 8 gigayears.
So the full line is still the total, and the dashed line is still the low metallicity one?
Full line is total, and the dashed is actually a subset of the model. So what we did, we actually did not look exactly at the LIGO event. We looked at binaries which had at least 15 and 25 solar masses for each component. So 40 solar masses total. And the dashed line is if you take exactly 34 and 29. Plus or minus 5 solar masses. So the dashed line is really LIGO-like, and this one is slightly different, but the idea was to have a decent vision of really massive systems.
This is kind of already involved with your delay time distribution.
Yes, yes.
So I guess the question is, do you have a star formation
this one. This one is lower at least, it's therefore.
I want the integral, because you
have oh,
the
no.
10 to the 8, 10 to the 9, I want the total in the universe, right?
No, I don't have that.
Because that would be the useful plot if yeah. somebody else had a different delay time distribution.
Yeah. No, but I can do that, but I do not have... Well, I think I actually have them, but I didn't put them here. So coming back to these two distributions, you see that this one is actually at a slightly lower metallicity on average than the high redshift formation blob here. But you see that if you integrate them all, typically you peak at a metallicity of about 0.1, which is what people have been looking at mostly. So the idea is it's a bimodal distribution in terms of galaxy mass, formation time, and metallicity, but with an overall rather flat distribution. And interestingly also, if you look at the integrated galaxy masses here, in the distribution for galaxy masses, this is very different from what you would see with an optical telescope, for example. If you look at galaxies, your luminosity function does not look like this. So this hopefully is going to be interesting when LIGO has hundreds or 200s of detections, and then maybe galaxy people will start realizing that there's a lot of information about dwarfs and stuff and that they can't really see otherwise. And that's it. Well, these are binary black holes. So position is, I don't know how. But. Yeah, so this is actually my last slide. The idea is that I was very excited about this, and I'm realizing the galaxy evolution people are not really up to speed yet, and I hope with this they will soon start to catch up, because a few years from now there will be a lot. And on the other side, having better rates would imply a better modeling of galaxy formation to have, yeah, comparable rates. Thank you.
Tea now, cookies. I think this time for real. And then in 10 minutes, we have the talk by the journalist in the auditorium. And thank you,
everyone.
Thanks, Gerald. Yeah, please thank Mr. Gerald. So.